Let's do this, the Cult of Hockey podcast. By the faithful and for the faithful. I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal, and I'm here today with Bruce McCurdy. Welcome, Bruce.
Hey, David.
How are you doing?
Well, better today than yesterday. Yesterday was a tough slog of a day. I attended memorial services for the four young local boys that were all lost their lives in the Humboldt tragedy, and it was definitely worth the time and getting to know them a little bit. But man, oh man, it was cumulatively contains quite a wallop, and it's ongoing here almost 2 weeks later.
Yeah, I mean, this is for the families, it's a tragedy that won't end, and the community remains shaken up by it. There's been lots of very fine words and from the families and from other people about the boys and about what their lives meant and what hockey means to us. And the most moving thing I saw was there was this video. I don't know if you saw it. It was on Twitter. Everyone's putting hockey sticks out on their front porches in memorial of the boys.
Got one out in my own porch.
Me too. And there was this video, a mother had put a hockey stick out there with green tape signifying the Humboldt colors. Mm-hmm. And her son came home from school and they have a security system where they video. He saw the stick and he was out there testing the stick. You know how you bend the stick to see its flex. And he practiced a few shots. And then as he was just about ready to put the stick back, he'd give it a little kiss.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
In memory of those boys. So,
and the adults and the girl, the female trainer.
The trainer,
It was just brutal stories, one on top of another.
Yeah.
And some good stuff. I mean, Connor McDavid going to visit them in hospital and Tom McClellan doing the same. I mean, there's a lot of certainly community support.
One good thing, Bruce, that's come out of the Humboldt thing is one of the players signed an organ donor card and his family was took some solace in that, as they should. And I think, other people were inspired to sign their organ donor cards, and I'm going to go online. I don't know if I've done it yet. I can't honestly remember, but that's something I'm going to do. If that's something that comes out of this, if that's one of the threads, that would be significant. So that's something for everyone to think about. It's a personal choice. For me, the reason I was against signing it is I saw an episode of Quincy years ago, Bruce, where someone, an evil doctor had killed a patient to steal their organs. And this stupid kind of fictional story had made me think, oh, I'm not going to sign my organ donor card because that might happen to me. So just this kind of, that's a ridiculous reason, right? But I think a lot of us haven't thought this through and taken that action with organ donor cards.
The evil doctor could forge your signature.
it was silly, right? It's silly.
Yeah, I signed mine. It's in my wallet, but hopefully
apparently,
not enacted.
Apparently, Bruce, you have to go through a different process. Now, I'm not sure, and I'm speaking out of ignorance here, but in some provinces, the wallet thing has gone by the wayside, and you have to actually go online and register now. So that's something maybe to check. I haven't checked it myself in Alberta. So today, Bruce, we're going to talk about the assistant coaches situation, dig into the prospects down in Bakersfield a little bit. I watched Bakersfield's final game of the year, and I got my first impression of Cooper Marody. And then we're going to start a series where we evaluate the Oilers position by position. We'll start with the centers today. So the assistant coaches, the Oilers are currently having a review of coaches right now. And it looks like Kurt Levens, the Cult of Hockey, and other people discussed a rumor this weekend that the Oilers have already decided to let go Jim Johnson, who ran the special teams penalty killing unit and was in charge of, I think, the defenseman, if I'm not mistaken, on the Oilers.
Yes.
This all comes as the Calgary Flames have fired coach Glenn Gallutzen and two of his assistants. So the Calgary finished with 84 points this year, the Oilers with 78. I think everyone, almost everyone going into the season, most people thought the Oilers would be finishing ahead of the Flames in the standings. McClellan's had three years on the job, but the definite buzz we're getting from the mainstream media, people like Ryan Rashog and others, Jim Matheson, who covered the team, is that McClellan's staying around and maybe some assistant coaches are going. What do you think should happen, Bruce, in terms of the assistant coaches?
Oh, boy.
I mean, I'll tell you what I think. I think they need to get replace them. Maybe keep Dustin Schwartz if they think he's got good rapport with Talbot, but replace all the rest of them.
Well, if you're going off of this year's results, I mean, there's a grounds case to be made for
I would be fine with that as well.
I mean, Dustin Schwartz, I mean, if you look at how the goalies performed this year, it wasn't good. Jim Johnson, the defense had a tough year. Mind you, injuries played a huge factor in that guy's playing with injuries. But he was responsible for the defense group on a team that dropped from 8th to 27th in goals against. And, of course, he was the man running the penalty kill. And apparently this is the most damning testimony that I've heard from a couple of sources, including Bob Stauffer, that only after Todd McClellan himself started to take charge of the penalty killing did they turn around, and did they ever turn it around. So maybe we should keep Todd McClellan as a penalty kill coach.
Which I would be okay with, Bruce. Like, I don't say that's necessarily the right way to go, but based on the Oilers' performance, I think it's completely justified to do what Calgary did. And just have a complete change here. You know, that said, you know, I'm okay with McClellan coming back, but I do think based on the penalty kill was bad for a year. The power play was bad all year. Didn't show any clue, any sign of solving the problem. I mean, if that's your job and you failed at it for a year in a league like the NHL, which is all about winning, then it's, you know, that's it. Move on. Like, there's other people, highly skilled people you can find It's time for a change there. I didn't see – the thing I didn't like about the power play, Bruce, was both the wrong people were chosen for the power play, people who weren't succeeding out there like Lucic and Letestu got a ton of minutes. And they also – my pet peeve is not having shooters setting up in the right positions to get off their most dangerous shot. And I didn't see that. I saw Draisaitl way out at the point. You know, what was that about?
Yeah.
And I saw, I didn't see anyone on the left faceoff circle all year long who was capable of delivering a hard shot, even though they had Puljujärvi on the bench all year. What was that about? Mm-hmm. So I just, I know partly it's about team chemistry and you gotta earn it, but you earn it. I think you fundamentally earn power play time by succeeding on the power play. And if that's and maybe there's some other codes and rules in place that are beyond us mere mortal hockey fans, but that seems to be how you would earn it to me, is by actually executing on the power play. And I never saw Puljujärvi once on that left circle, maybe once, like he kind of shifted in there for a second or two, but
I saw him. I was at a game and he scored a goal from there. And I thought, oh, this is promising. He took a pass. Somebody passed the puck about 6 feet behind him, and he used that long reach of his to cradle the puck, pull it in, and wham, snap it into the top corner. And I thought, oh, I'd like to see a whole lot more of that, and then didn't.
How many goals do you think we saw from one-timer shots from the left circle, Bruce, this year, from that side of the ice? How many shots? And I think last year with Letestu, when he was successful there, we probably saw about 10 shots go in from there, all told, from different players. That kind of goal. I think we might have seen two or three this year.
Yeah, Letestu got one in Chicago in overtime, four-on-three power play in overtime early in the season. And otherwise, they're thin on the ground. I mean, the one I described from Puljujärvi wasn't quite a one-timer, but it certainly was a very decisive receive the pass and snap it into the net. I'm not sure Strome, for all that he's got a pretty wicked shot. I don't remember him actually producing that shot off of that left circle.
He might have gotten one goal. So if you're the power play coach, you've got to figure that out. And you've got to figure out how can we score off the right circle. And from the right circle, how many goals did we see this year? I think we saw Draisaitl score maybe four or five power play goals from there. That might be a little generous, but he did. They eventually did start going to him there, and McDavid might have got a couple. But again, they never got any. And from how many from the point?
Oh, virtually none. Klefbom scored a fluke in garbage time in Montreal that bounced in off a defender's shin pad, you know, in a game where the Oilers had a comfortable lead anyway. And otherwise, Ethan Bear got the one where he snuck into the left circle. And I mean, I'm not kidding here. Yeah. I don't think the Oilers' D-men scored many more power play goals than that as a group.
It was just like the lack of, it's like an NBA team that didn't hit one 3-point, that hit like 5 3-point shots all year. Like, you got to do a little better, gentlemen. And that's, you know, you could say, well, it's all on the players. But no, you know, that was also on the coaches having the wrong players on this. Letestu clearly showed that he didn't have that shot this year, and yet they stuck with him well into January, I think, in that spot. And they never gave a shot to Puljujärvi. They never even Slepyshev, who's got a decent shot, never got a sniff there. Yeah. Pakarinen, who's got a decent shot, is he a right shot? Pakarinen,
he's a right shot.
He never got it. He never got a chance. I'm not, but you know, Puljujärvi has. They drafted this guy, Bruce, to be a scorer from that spot. Really, that's what he's always done his whole career. He did it in the World Junior Tournament. He did it in the AHL in Bakersfield. They were finally playing him there. And this is part of my critique of Bakersfield is in his first stint there last year, they didn't use him there consistently. They started to this year. So, I don't know. I just think it was
a... He was a whiz on the power play. And anytime I saw him with Finland, which was two different tournaments.
Yeah.
You know, I just looked it up, by the way, and I remembered both power play goals scored by an Oilers defenseman this year. Two goals by the defense. Entire season. Brutal.
Yeah, that is brutal. So they
they were the first team in NHL history to finish 31st in the league in power play percentage. And that was piggybacked on them being the 31st and last team in power play opportunities. And in fact, they had the lowest number of power play opportunities since that record has been maintained when the Oilers came into the league for anything but a lockout shortened season. 210 chances for the entire season, lowest ever. So they weren't doing enough to draw penalties, whether that was a style of play thing, whether it was a ref thing, whatever the reason was, you know, like the power play,
Bruce, all year we had Johan Ovitu, who was purported to be a power play specialist and who has had success again in other cities, other leagues, other teams on the running the power play. Mm-hmm. We hardly saw him all year, and we saw Matt Benning all year. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was ridiculous. I just think it was not defensible, the player personnel decisions on the power play, and I think they need a new power play coach. I don't think...
Yeah.
That's probably the least controversial statement I could make about the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah. Well, I had plenty of issues with the personnel choices and even strength also. So, you know, there's issues that just cascade up and down from the blue paint out to the, you know, to the forward core. And it just was a pretty disastrous season for the organization, and the coaching staff has to own their share of that.
Yeah, and the way you own it is by, if the head coach is sticking around by realizing, wow, I need some help here. I got a lot wrong. So it's one thing to say I take responsibility. It's another thing to say I got a lot wrong, and I never heard that. So people were saying, well, Chiarelli didn't take responsibility, and he didn't. But McClellan, yeah, he took responsibility in the most general sense, but he didn't say I got a lot wrong.
And he said he looked in the mirror, but that was...
Yeah, well, he didn't say what he was looking at. Now, maybe that's too much to ask. Like the specific things that he should be looking at, like for him to enunciate those things. But it's not too much to ask for major, major change on that coaching staff. I'm hoping we see that. So I think we'll see that with Johnson, but Woodcroft is the question mark. And this leads into Bakersfield, because Stauffer's making some noises that, it's not unusual for NHL teams to send their assistant coaches down to become head coaches in Bakers in the AHL, and I'm that is probably accurate. I'm sure you could find lots of examples, some examples of that. So does that mean Woodcroft is heading to Bakersfield? And Bruce, just because he got it wrong on the power play, I'm not saying that he's an incompetent coach, because he's had success in other years, a lot of success. And maybe that would be a reasonable thing to do, would be to send him to Bakersfield, because Bakersfield hasn't had either a lot of success, A, playing, developing NHL players, or succeeding in the AHL in the last few years under Jerry Fleming. So I think a coaching change in there wouldn't be extraordinary. It's almost expected. What would you think if Woodcroft got that job?
Well,
I mean, I wouldn't be thrilled, honestly, but
it's been known to happen. I mean, the Oilers sent Kelly Buckberger down to coach a year in the minor leagues, and he got decent results, and they brought him back up. But, I mean, any assistant coach that has wants to go on to be a head coach will take some would call it a demotion to the AHL to be a head man. I mean, Todd Nelson, he was an assistant coach in Atlanta for 2 years. And he went from that, and he took the head coaching job in the Oilers farm system just to be a head coach, to be the man in charge, to build his, experience and resume and so on. And, of course, he wound up getting a job here for a while. And his name keeps coming up. Like, recently he's been mentioned as a possible interview candidate to replace Ken Hitchcock in Dallas. And if Jay Woodcroft has ever been mentioned as a possible coaching candidate elsewhere, I just have not heard it. And the same goes for any of the entire cast of assistant coaches right now, or the minor league coach.
Todd Nelson would be a heck of a coach. He seems to be a coach who can build up the offensive confidence in his players, the people that he's handling in that moment. We saw it with Yakupov and Derek Roy. He found a way to make Yakupov effective. Todd Nelson did. That's pretty substantial achievement, considering a number of highly respected coaches like Hitchcock and McClellan have not succeeded in doing that. Something to take a player that is problematic and troublesome to work with, as Yakupov seems to be for whatever reason, and get good results out of him. That speaks, that's Ralf Krueger too, got that done. And I think the Oilers need that on their staff right now. It's that kind of coach who can build up the offensive confidence of these players, get them attacking better. So, yeah, Woodcroft hasn't been mentioned. I don't know if he's the right guy for Bakersfield, but that's...
And you won't hear Jerry Fleming mentioned as a possible NHL candidate either. The results just don't... They're not there. And in defense of Jerry Fleming, he didn't have a lot to work with this year. I mean, the talent level at Oklahoma City, especially among the forwards, was pretty much pathetic until the very last weeks of the season, when they started adding these late season amateur tryout offers, including Cooper Marody that you mentioned earlier, but also Tyler Benson and Ostap Safin and a few players of that nature that, they'll be around. I think they're next year, at least most of those guys. There's an option on Safin. And whoever is the coach next year will have a lot more to work with in terms of skilled.
The only thing I would say about that is I don't know what role Fleming played in terms of recommending like players like Mitch Callahan or re-upping Ryan Hamilton. I think Hamilton might have got a 2-year deal when he signed. Like the veterans, if it's on Fleming's recommendation that you keep Fleming around or Ryan Hamilton around, he was done. As a player, and he's getting ample ice time, and he couldn't produce at all this year. So there's kind of like how much is on the coach, how much is on the players that the GM brings in. I mean, that's ultimately the GM's job, but he is going on recommendations of other people. And yeah. Yep. So Cooper, let's talk about something a little bit happier here, Bruce. So Cooper Marody, frankly, wowed me. I want to say for what it's worth, because this time last year I would have been talking about having seen Ziet Paigan in a short run of games and how impressed I was with him at the time, and rating him as a prospect higher than Ethan Bear, I think. So these short viewings of games, I have come to learn, can be as misleading as they are informative. And you have to be really careful when you see a player in a few games. So I'm just going to talk about my first impression. And what I missed with Pygan, and it's funny that I missed this because I did see him in about five or six games, but when he came into training camp this year, it was like he could not skate backwards. He was getting beat constantly in the young gun games by people coming at him.
Protecting games.
It was ridiculous.
Not a good sign.
It was ridiculous how little he could defend, but he didn't seem to have that problem. I mean, I watched him defending backwards. I don't know, like, did someone sharpen his skates wrong or anyway, I just think it is more indicative of how you could be misled in a short number of games than anything. But so Marody, he, man alive, and you can watch some of the video clips because they're online. The puck had the proverbial puck on the string, Bruce. He can really stick handle. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to, because I like to compare players to players of the 1970s, he reminded me of André Lacroix. Very skilled. And Lacroix was mainly
the all-time WHA scoring.
He was just fantastic with the puck. And so is Cooper Marody. He can really stick handle. He made one move or a forehand deke where he just burned the Ontario Reign defenseman, went right around him. He did a number of fine cross seam passes. He looked really good on the left face-off circle on the power play, both shooting and moving the puck. I don't think he's got a great shot, but he can really make a pass. And he's not super fast, but he's very elusive. And so you saw him play too, didn't you, in a couple games?
Yeah, I did.
In the playoffs for Michigan, or?
Yeah, right after the trade, Michigan was in the regionals that weekend. So they were in the final 16, and then they won the regional tournament to go to the Frozen Four, and that was 2 weeks later, which is why Marody didn't show up in Bakersfield until the very end. They got beaten in the national semifinal. But I saw the bits and pieces and a lot of Marody shifts in the two games in the regional that they won. And he had a pair of goals, including the late game winner in the first of those games. And I'm not sure he had any points, but he impressed me just as much, if not more, in the second game. Just very, very smart and creative with the puck. And a right-handed stick, which is nice to see. Decent size. I'm not sure. You know, he may be a perimeter player. He may be, you know, it's hard to get, as you say, a full read on a guy in a couple.
Well, he kind of plays the Nugent Hopkins game, right? Like, he's fast, smart. Like, he's not as talented as Ryan Nugent Hopkins, obviously. But, you know, that's his game, right? He's playing a version of that game, someone who can really handle the puck and shoot it a bit and really pass it and is smart. So those,
and he led the conference in scoring this year. So it's not like, I heard some people say, well, geez, we should have kept that third round pick and swung for the fences.
What?
And I'm thinking, that third round pick today, that third round pick is either 16 or 17 years old. Whereas Cooper Marody is already 21. He's shown significant improvement. And this year really was his first full year in college where he was healthy for the whole year. The first year he was there, he got mono.
Yeah.
And then his grades, not only did his hockey suffer, his grades suffered, and he didn't qualify to play for the first semester of his second year there. So he only played half the year. And then this year he played the whole year healthy, and he led the conference in scoring. I mean, those are very positive arrows in terms of how quickly he made that next step as a junior, being the conference leader. And yeah, he's 21. And so that's a late blooming prospect, but geez, I don't know how many 17 and 18 year old prospects do you want? The problem this year is we didn't have enough 21 year olds in Bakersfield, and they went out and made the move to get this guy, and they signed Cameron Hebig in out of Regina Pats, an overage junior that was filling the net for he's with Regina Pats now. He was filling the net in the WHL this year, had a very good year there. And there's just going to be this infusion of skill. Those were the centers that they got, and then the wingers I mentioned already, with Saffin and Benson and so forth. And of course, we've got Kyler Yamamoto that's going to enter that mix as well. He's going to be a pro next year for sure. Whether Bakersfield or Edmonton, we'll see. But he's certainly going to be in the professional mix, and there's going to be a much needed, very welcome infusion of actual talented, skilled young forwards into the system. And
yeah, with Benson and Yamamoto, and yeah,
finally,
and Marody certainly on that list. So he's those Yamamoto and Benson are born in 98, as is Puljujärvi. So there's three guys there. And then there's Marody, who was born in 96, December 96.
Late 96.
Yeah. So he's really a 90, you know, he's more than, you know, he's a kind of a year apart from Yamamoto. Is that right?
Hebig is January 97.
Yeah. And then there's lots of, no 95s to speak of. And then there's the 94s that Shirelli talked about, you know, Kajula, Slepyshev. Are in that camp, and is Ratty
Benning,
and well, Benning's a defenseman. We're just talking about the forwards, not
yeah,
the Benning.
Yeah, yeah, there was four. Kara's
the Kara's a 94, and Ratty's a 93, I think.
Yes.
So, it's hard. The problem is counting on any of those guys for next year, right? In the top six, and I think it's possible that I'd like to see Marody and Yamamoto get half a year each in the bake and see them dominate. So Marody got 3 points in three games. Can he do that? Can he get 30 points in 30 games?
That'd be nice.
Can Yamamoto get 30 points in 30 games? Because that's the sign of a dominant attacker at the HL level, and someone who might be able to translate into the NHL with like maybe 20 points in 30 games, possibly, if they're played in a top six situation in the NHL as well, right? If they can get that going.
HL scoring is, I mean, this year the scoring champion had 71 points.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, there you go. It's like a point a game is significant. That is fantastic. So can Marody do that? And based on his skill set, there's a chance. The guy can wheel and deal. So, and he'll get some power play time there as well, because they'll have him on the looks like Benson would probably play, is the most logical candidate for the right circle on the power play, with Marody on the left circle, and both those guys can really throw that puck around, pass that puck very well. So it's going to be exciting to see that Bakersfield team next year, and
more exciting than it was this year.
Mitch Callahan was a really decent player on a team, the Grand Rapids team, that went and they won, didn't they? They won the Calder Cup last year. And he was looked like a really solid bet to sign, and he got nothing all year. Like, I don't know what
went wrong. And he got suspended, eh?
He did, eh? Wow.
For PEDs, was it? I think I'm just going off an ancient memory, but I think he had some issue with some supplement. Let's put it that way, that went awry of the law, and whether, you know, usual player proclaims innocence, you know, but, and don't quote me on that, but I think I'm in the ballpark. He did get suspended.
So Bruce,
they had Grayson Downing.
He did nothing. Furlan was Brian injured. Brian
Furlan, that was coming off 2 years of basically missing the whole year with injury. They wasted a spot on the 50-man list on him, and he missed this. He played seven games after playing two games last year. And what was that about?
So a couple players, you know, Gambardella and Russell look good. I'm going to watch more Bakersfield games though, Bruce. So I'm not going to say much more about like all these other players, Benson and Gambardella, and before I want to watch at least five. I'm gonna watch a few more games, and then I'll open it. So we were gonna talk about the centers, Bruce, but we've already gone pretty long here. So let's. I just wanted to talk about one thing about the centers, and we'll get to them. We'll do a full review next time, our next podcast. I do want to talk about Letestu though. So he's now in the playoffs with Columbus, and Columbus is two wins and a loss. So here's Mark Letestu's ice time in Edmonton this season. All right.
Yep.
He played 851 at even strength per game, 155 shorthanded per game, and 217 on the power play per game.
Yep.
In Columbus, in the three playoff games, he's played 734 at even strength, 327 on the PK, which places him not actually at, that's a high number, but they've had a lot of penalties. He's on
is
this,
that per, this is per game?
327 per game.
Wow.
They've had a ton of penalties. So he's actually fourth, I think fourth for forwards in PK time. So he's on the second unit. He's out there a lot. They're trusting him on the PK and 017 on the power play. And Bruce, I'm going to suggest that if the Oilers had used Mark Letestu about seven minutes, they came close to that. Now they had him at nine. So that was pretty close. His even strength time on the Oilers wasn't really an issue. And I think I didn't like him on the PK at all, but I think if they had just had him focus on that this year, that might've been a much better idea.
Well, and that's what's
coming. They're not using him on the power play, and that's what they're doing.
And they did get lit up for three power play goals in game two by Washington. Now, I didn't pay close attention to who
neither
was
did I. Maybe he's getting, maybe but, he's the problem. I don't know. We'll have to look.
My go-to stat for penalty killing is time on ice, but then you got to look too. at the results. And it's not just, well, the coach trusts him, therefore he's good. It's that, well, the coach trusts him, but should he have? And his results on the PK and the power play really this year. I mean, he was a special teams monster for the Oilers last year, and his fall off the cliff. I mean, there was a few players whose performance dropped so substantially this year, and I would say Cam Talbot and Oscar Klefbom would be two more important examples. But Letestu just was unable to duplicate his play from 16-17, and
because of usage, that was hugely significant for the Edmonton Oilers.
Well, he was still a special. There was a lot of nights. I mean, this guy's a fourth line center. There's a lot of nights. One of the things I like to do is combine special teams ice time. Just look at how much did the guy play on both special teams combined. He'd be number one on the team, a fourth line center. And it happened a lot of nights.
Yeah, well, you know, Glenn Sather, when they won the Cups, he used to play Billy Carroll more minutes than Wayne Gretzky constantly, Bruce. And Ray Cote, he also played more minutes on special teams than Wayne Gretzky.
So this is
fundamentally sound coaching, Bruce, and should not be questioned by the likes of you and me.
I think Wayne Gretzky played more time on the penalty kill than either of those penalty killing specialists who never saw the light of day on a power play. So I'm calling your bluff on that one, Dave.
I'm not a very nice person, Bruce. Sarcastic comments far too often. All right. It's the Don Rickles influence, man. I just thought he was the funniest thing when I was growing up. Too much Merv Griffin for me, man.
Uh-huh.
Don Rickles on Merv Griffin. Yeah. And I took it straight into the classroom. My teachers love me. All right.
Sarcastic or sardonic? I prefer a mix myself.
What is the definition of sardonic?
Oh boy, now you're putting.
Sorry, I'm putting you on the spot. I think I looked it up the other day, it sardonic? Fairly caustic.
Caustic, yeah,
maybe I'm both sardonic and sarcastic. My mom used to say around the supper table, sarcasm is the lowest form of humor. All right, let's leave it there, Bruce. Thanks for talking today.
Yeah, we'll talk about the grimly mocking or cynical sardonic. Grimly mocking. That's not you, though, David, surely. That doesn't describe you, does it? Anyway, next time we'll talk about the center wingers, and then after that we can talk about the winger centers on the subsequent. Because all the centers played wing, it seems like, so... Figure out a way to split the forwards into a couple of categories, and we can talk about each set.
All right. Thanks again, Bruce.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
And in the meantime, and in between times, this has been another edition of the Cult of Hockey podcast.